Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. In our first hour, we're going to be talking with both Taylor Branch, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of Parting the Waters, the trilogy about Martin Luther King and the years he lived in our country during those years. And he's written many of the books he's been on the show for over the years. But his new work came out of an Atlantic Monthly article that appeared in October issue called The Shame of College Sports. It's really the history of the NCAA and what he calls, in a sense, almost tantamount to slavery, what's happening to college athletes, the game that's being played. This is also something our other guest has written about years ago and has been talking about for a long time and commented very well in this article. That's Frank DeFord, of course, you know, sports commentator for HBO Real Sports and National Public Radio and senior contributing writer at Sports Illustrated, author of many, many books. And both these gentlemen have been on my show on and off over the years, and it's a pleasure to have them both on at the same time. Taylor Branch, Frank DeFord, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
How are you, Frank?
Fine, thank you.
Good.
Frank, it's nice to meet you. I've been a tourist in the sports world for many years, all the way back to ghostwriting a book for Bill Russell, and I've admired your work all this time. It's nice to meet you on the phone.
Well, it is, Taylor, and if you're a tourist, you're a very educated tourist.
And folks, the lines are open, 410-319-8888. The article that Taylor wrote, Taylor Branch wrote, The Shame of College Sports, is really eye-opening about the history of the NCAA and what happens with college athletes and how it all began. Let me just begin, Taylor, before we jump into the piece of the article. I just want you to give our listeners a sense of why you tackled this, what you tackled. I mean, In exposing the history of football in America and sports and college sports and the ultimate being of the NCAA.
I went to my friends at the Atlantic magazine and said I wanted to do a magazine assignment before I disappeared from my usual 5 years on a book assignment. And they asked me for some topics, and I gave them some, and they said, do you have anything else? And I said, well, as an old high school athlete and passing sports fan, I've always been curious why the NCAA is in perpetual scandal, and they never are able to do anything. And I went to North Carolina, and Bill Friday is a big reformer there, and he was my idol and mentor when I was. And I know he's a reformer. And the Atlantic editor said, that's what you should do. You should do college sports. It would surprise our readers, and it would surprise your readers who are accustomed to you writing about history. And I said, but I really don't know anything about it. And they said, all the better. You can go in as an outsider with the force of wonder and discovery, which is what I did, because I went all the way back to the Civil War and kind of surveyed the development of college sports and why we're the only country in the world that plays big money sports in universities. And it was a great odyssey and wonder.
So let me just jump in here with one more thing before we bring Frank right into the conversation. I want to read a piece from the beginning of your article in a second as well. I mean, this whole idea of student-athlete, the whole idea of the power athletics in our university and college systems is one that, as you write about, starts in the 19th century, the beginning of football.
Right. Well, the 19th century, I mean, not to put – this is too crude a summary, but when the rest of the Western nations were colonizing the world after the between the Civil War and World War I, we didn't have a colonial system, but we were caught up in the social Darwinist macho machismo era. And this is when the Olympics were revived, too, almost to give a sense of idealism about discovering – awakening to world conquest. So to oversimplify, Europe colonized the world, and we started college football to be really tough, to show how tough we were. And it was a sensation from the end of the Civil War up through World War I. College sports were a wonderful thing, and it was concentrated. They were concentrated in the Ivy Leagues and the Northeast.
But the colleges and the students built the sports. This wasn't the world we have today. They built the stadiums. They did it all.
The students scheduled their own games for a long time. They coached themselves. They would get alumni to do it. It was a contagion among alumni. Now, that didn't mean there wasn't money changing hands, but it was betting and that sort of thing. Harvard Stadium, it stunned me to find out that Harvard Stadium was built in 1903 without a nickel from Harvard University. It was all built by alumni because the coach was not paid. But Harvard was losing to Yale so often that they broke down one of the amateur practices, which was not to pay the coach, and hired their first coach in 1905 And lost to Yale anyway, and then went to Theodore Roosevelt and basically—
A Harvard man.
And Roosevelt kind of said, we need to reform college sports, and created what became the NCAA, basically to reform a violent sport, but also to change the rules. And he got the Yale man out of the rules committee and put a Harvard man in. And Harvard still lost, but the NCAA was born.
So in the beginning of this article, I just want to read the little piece here from the article to get us started. And to talk a bit about Frank, why he was so taken with this article as well. You start off with this Sonny Vaccaro, who is a shoe pimp, as you put in your book, for Reebok.
Well, he worked for Reebok, Adidas, and Nike, all three of them.
So he's in front of the Nike Commission on intercollegiate athletics. And Vaccaro says, "I'm not hiding," he said to this closed session. "We want to put our materials on the bodies of your athletes, and the best way to do it is to buy your school or buy your coach." And then Bryce Jordan chimes in, who's president emeritus of Penn State. "Why should a university be an advertising medium for industry?" And as you write, Vaccaro did not blink. "They shouldn't, sir. You sold your souls, and you're going to continue selling them. You can be very moral and righteous by asking me the question, sir. But there's not one of you in this room that's not going to turn down any of our money. You're going to take it, and I can only offer it."
Bill Friday told me about that confrontation. I didn't really believe him, and he told it almost that way. But that is a verbatim transcript of that thing that was buried in the Knight Commission records. And it was powerful enough that I chose it to open the article and the ebook, and then eerie now because this was only 2 months ago, but it was before the Penn State scandal, and he's confronting the former president of Penn State. And now Penn State is in the soup.
So, Frank.
Yes, sir.
You wrote a piece, a short piece on why you thought this article was important. You've been talking about this for a long time. This is something way back in your days when you founded your sports paper, The National.
I go back before that. I covered basketball when I came to Sports Illustrated in the 60s, and I remember at that time it was a relatively minor sport, and I was covering both the college and the pros. And as it got bigger, they said, "Well, you have to choose one or the other. You want to cover the college, you want to cover the pros." I said, "Well, that's no question. I want to cover the pros. I want to cover something that's honest." So even as a kid of 26 or 27, I mean, I knew how corrupt it was and just how deceitful. And it's only gotten more so with more money. And, of course, football is a bigger slice of the pie, a much bigger slice of the pie than basketball, but it's just amazing to me. I mean, you said it in the preface there that America is the only place in the world where there is such a thing as big time college sports. It's crazy, and particularly at a time when we are, you know, having struggles with education. To waste all this money on college sports is just ridiculous. And by the way, it dips down into the high schools too.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's read Friday Night Lights or whatever knows that very well indeed. It's an epidemic.
So, and I'm going to get to the epidemic and what we think we do about it and have our listeners join us here, 410-319-8888. We're sitting on the campus of a school that is part of the NCAA, like every other school that has basketball, football, and so they're all here. And so you can join us at 410-319-8888. I mean, let's talk for a minute quickly, Taylor, about how the NCAA started and how it got so powerful. Because it's an amazing story that I think few people know, how they dominate, at least now, the world of basketball and a lot of other college athletics.
Well, I'm interested in Frank's take on this, too, because in one sense they're very powerful. In another sense, they're the big bad wolf huffing and puffing, trying to look powerful. They had no power whatsoever until after World War II. They couldn't do anything. They tried to enact a sanity code, what they called a sanity code,
right,
to keep people from cheating and spending money and to be real amateurs. And it was laughed at and voted out. And then there was this amazing perfect storm when they hired Walter Byers, who's the founding architect of the NCAA, in 1951. And in that same year, there were these terrible scandals where Kentucky basketball players were frog marched in handcuffs because they were caught up in a point shaving thing. And they were the national champion basketball team. And Byers, and at the same time, television was starting. And believe it or not, people, buyers convinced all the colleges that television was a dire threat to college sports because people would stay home and watch on TV for free, and that and that television needed to be regulated like nuclear weapons. This is the height of the Cold War, and that only the NCAA should be able to sign television contracts for football games. And he sold that. That's the beginning of the cartel. Two schools, Notre Dame and Penn, tried to revolt because they said, we're trying experimental contracts. Why should you get a cut of this? And he faced them down. And that was the beginning of the NCAA's financial power. And it grew for 30 years through the early days of television until the football schools got sick of sharing their money with the NCAA and having them restrict it. And they went to the Supreme Court and said, the NCAA is a cartel like OPEC, and we want to make all the money we can and play all the games we want and get all the TV contracts. And they won in the Supreme Court. And consistently, when people sue the NCAA, which has no legal foundation whatsoever, it's just an association of schools who get together and say, we're not going to pay our athletes, and we're going to have the gall to say that we're doing it for their own good. it's really astonishing that they do that, and they get people to believe it. It's like Alice in Wonderland. They've done that, but consistently the courts have said, when the adults challenge it and say, this is not right because it's restricting my money, the courts always say, absolutely right, this is a free country, you're entitled to what you want, which the coaches got together and sued and won a $54 million judgment against the NCAA, and now, of course, we have million-dollar assistant coaches. But the kids, the athletes, although they're legally adults, are still prohibited from getting any money in this system.
Except under the table.
Except under the table, right? So they're taught to be cynical, and they're taught to close their eyes, and they're taught to dream pipe dreams, because there's no real education on how the economics of college sports fits into the real world.
I mean, Mark, it's even more impressive in that if you went back 50 years, American college sports were not alone in espousing amateurism, even in the face of money. And then one by one, all the major Olympic sports, tennis and outside of the Olympics, gave up the ghost and said, this isn't right. And if people are going to make money, then the athletes should make money too. So not only are we the only place in the world that has high, strong college sports, we're also the only place in the world where there is amateurism and big money on the same table. Only place, American college basketball and football. Nowhere else in the world does it happen. Rugby was the last one to go honest, and that was about 1995.
Good point. I didn't know. I knew about the Olympics because it just occurred to me when I'm going through this. People are so emotionally attached, Frank, I find, to the idea of amateur. There's something about innocence that tucked it. A lot of sensible people just throw up their hands in horror. And I kind of did, too. When I started on this, Bill Friday gave me the mission of going in there and figuring out a way to get the money, drain the money out of the swamp of college athletics and give the university back to Socrates. That was his mission. And I finally had to come back to him and say, Bill, you may do that, but you're never going to even confront these problems as long as you're pretending that commercialized sports have a right to pauperize these students and exclude them. You know, the NCAA excludes the athletes from membership. They don't vote. So it makes rules for people that it excludes for membership. You know,
they're legally adults as well, by the way.
Right, and it's downright un-American.
So
it's also true. You talk about the amateurism, which everybody just adores. Which, of course, is hypocrisy anyway, because, of course, it never works. But anyway, the ideal of amateurism in sports. Nobody ever says that for instance, writers would do better if they were writing for free, or musicians, or actors, that we would all love our craft much more if we weren't getting paid.
Right.
If we really believed we were performing a public service, we could prove it by not taking any money.
Yes. Nobody would dare say that. And yet, football players and basketball players are supposed to do that. And as you say, perfectly rational people believe it, swear by it. So, of course, others are just making money off of it.
So, I mean, we have a system with our colleges now making I mean, literally billions of dollars are passing hands.
Literally billions.
Billions,
yes,
of dollars between colleges and sports companies and even Under Armour here in Baltimore, all of them. They're in the middle of this. And the athletes in the process in college have no due process.
No.
They had no workman's comp if they get hurt. Your article's full of stories of athletes who have gotten injured, paralyzed, and get, as my grandfather would say, bupkis, nothing, because they're not really employees. They don't get to share the revenues after they leave college. They're lawsuits because of all the digital world and using people's images and making tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, and athletes don't get a dime of it. And they're making money for the colleges, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, it's
a very, very bizarre, and it's coming apart. See,
yes,
you and I are talking about it. Frank and I have been talking about it on the grounds of elementary fairness. But the fact of the matter is, it's also coming apart just on practicality, because the big football schools and the big time sports schools they don't want to share their money with the 1,000 other NCAA schools that the NCAA has to spread the money out over so that it can claim to speak for all of athletics. And so they have consistently revolted against the NCAA. The football schools did. And now you've got this totally cattywampus, lopsided thing. The NCAA gets no money from football TV contracts. It gets all of its income, 95% of its income, just from the March Madness tournament. CBS Turner writes a check to the NCAA for $771 million every March for that month's work, out of which it gets all of its budget, which is quite lavish. It pays the teams in the tournament, and then it distributes money to every NCAA member in the United States. Well, the football schools don't like sharing all of that money with anybody, and they'd like to run the NCAA basketball tournament just like they'd like to run an NCAA football tournament. And that's the reason that the NCAA won't do any serious punishments these days. It's tiptoeing around. It's worrying that it's going to be come apart over fights over money, or at least that's what the athletic directors tell me. Is that the way you see it? I mean,
absolutely right, and it's also unraveling. You talk about unraveling. Our friend Sonny Vaccaro, who you start the the article with, Sonny is reformed. There's no question. He's gone from being a pimp to being this complete idealist, and he is inspiring a suit against the NCAA with regard to the images of the players, and I think that's going to be the thread that first unravels it.
Now, Oscar Robertson has joined that lawsuit as a plaintiff, saying that, you know, they're still making money off his image from college games 50 years ago. You must have covered him.
Oscar, they're still making – Oscar would only be in black and white. How could they possibly
– I know. And Bill Russell, who I know you know because I know he admires you, and he was one of my first books, was ghostwriting for Bill Russell. He's joined that. He says they're making money off of him. So it's a pretty amazing – but it's an antitrust suit.
So –
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Frank. Finish what you're saying.
No, it's just that I remember Ted Williams saying, and I'll leave out the vulgarity, he was trying to get Shoeless Joe Jackson in the Hall of Fame. And he said they gave him a lifetime. Only baseball could give a man a lifetime suspension and extend it for 50 years after he was dead. I'm sorry. I mean, that's really not apropos. It made me, if they're still getting money off of Bill Russell and Oscar Robertson, that's hilarious.
It really
they
is.
Are.
But they are, and all the other athletes are getting nothing, because only 1 or 2% of all athletes ever end up in basketball or football in professional sports.
No.
Even getting drafted.
Even getting drafted.
And, of course, to me, everybody talks when we're talking about practicalities, and it's amazing to me that everybody presumes that they should have a say in how sports should be organized without addressing the fact that the athletes themselves have no say and all that. But the way that it works now, I lost my train. Go ahead.
That's okay. 410-319-8888. And I mean, I want to open these phones. I want the college athletes who listen to this program, coaches, parents, people who are interested in watch all of us sit and watch the tube and watch games. It's part of the American persona. But does it need to change? 410-319-8888. And you know, Frank, I want to ask this question as we launch the phones here. I mean, I remember you many, many years ago, you've been on record for a long time saying that professional football, and I said this when Taylor spoke to the Nature Group where I was visiting, professional football and basketball, minor leagues should replace college, replace the idea of college sports in terms of the paying athletes. If they're going to be paid, create a minor league and do it that way and get it out of college. And I said that to somebody, and they had an argument with me outside the meeting we were in the couple of nights ago. I said, no, we should turn it over to big business and let them run it. They know what to do. So, Frank, just talk about what you think that means. And to me, let me add one more line to it, is that I really think that this kind of corruption of academia that's taken place because of college sports that you predicted 20 years ago as editor of the National.
Well, you're really talking about two different subjects there, but you'll never get minor league basketball and football as long as the colleges. If you're a kid, do you want to play in some minor league team in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, or do you want to play for the University of Nebraska where 80,000 people are going to be watching you and the scouts are going to be watching you? In other words, the system that's in place is just too strong to be overturned. The baseball minor leagues grew up in the 19th century at the same time that college sports were developing in football and subsequently in basketball. So I can't see that. It's a lovely pipe dream, but it's just simply never going to happen. They have a minor league, what they call developmental league in the NBA, and about eight people go out to watch the games. And so as a consequence, kids do not go play in the developmental NBA unless they get cut from the NBA, but they don't do it as a way of working up the ladder. Now, as far as sports affecting academia, just look at my profession of journalist. I would imagine that 99.8% of journalists who cover education in this country cover sports education, right?
Yep.
I mean, that just shows you. And I'd like to ask Taylor a question, which is how much of a response has he gotten from this extraordinarily, this just magnificent article? Has it done anything? Has it changed anything? Have the sports writers come out and examined it or celebrated it or kicked under more rocks? What's happened, Taylor?
Well, it has been a wild. It's been like a spacewalk for me. Because I didn't anticipate anything from the very first day when your commentary came out. The response has been viral, but it's been very, very uneven. It's ordinary folk. I was telling Mark just last week, I was up in New York, a forum of Harvard Business School graduates wanted to meet to try to devise a new business plan for making college sports work, acknowledging that the players deserved a share and that they deserve to be at the table. So it's been very wild, all kinds of things like that. But the sports, an awful lot of people are extremely emotional, saying that the idea that the athletes deserve a share will only make sports colleges more professional, more commercial, and undermine our colleges. And people are emotionally attached to the idea of amateurism. And I would say the biggest, the most shocking developments to me has been the relative lack of interest from students themselves. I was Skyping into a sports law class at a big university, and I asked the teacher to make sure to have the college newspaper editor there if he could get him. And I asked the college newspaper editor, is this something that you debate, these issues on your campus? And the editor said, quite frankly, sir, most of our students don't really care about the athletes here. They're off in the jock dorm, and people envy them. They're like circus performers, and we don't really most students don't care about them. So it's been a constant surprise, the uneven reaction here.
But I think that part of what I got from this article and the stuff that I've read before, especially Frank's and your work, Taylor, I mean, is that – but this is something that has to do with a sense of corruption and power that affects the entire society beyond sports.
Absolutely.
I mean, academia, what happens, who's important on campus, but also what is corrupt and what is honest behavior. I mean, this is wrapped up in some ways, I don't know if it's sidetracked in Paterno, but it's some ways connected to that because it's about the power of the money in the sport and how it corrupts the very essence of university. And in turn, I think corrupts people all the way down the line and around who watch sports and expect this is just a natural part of existence.
Well, let me ask you two comments on that because I'd love to know what Frank thinks about it. Number one, part of the charm of sports is that it's a place that we go where we can cheer and boo and we don't have to think.
Right.
And that's why we like it. It's romantic. It's colorful. It's great.
Right.
And you get victories. Well, unfortunately, we do need to think about how sports are organized here, and people resist that a great deal. But the other thing is, it seems to me that if you're going to – my alternative way to approach this is to give the athletes the respect that they're doing two different careers at once. They're having – if they're functioning, and an awful lot of them do, but we don't treat them as human beings who have an academic career meeting a certain set of standards and a professional career to satisfy their coaches at the same time. Instead, the NCAA created this fused notion that they're not students and athletes, but they're student-athletes, which is this Twilight Zone creature, only to give the NCAA control over them. You know, they will – if you talk to any NCAA official, they will use the phrase student-athlete at least twice in every sentence to try to create this sense that they own them and that it's a special creature. But they're not. They're ordinary creatures. They're trying to do amazing things. They're working. They're getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, going in and getting yelled at by a million-dollar coach. They're risking their bodies. They're working. They're sweating. They're dying. And then they try to go to class, and they stagger, and they do this, that, and that, and the other. And the rest of the world does not want to see them as human beings, and that really needs to change.
On our way to break, Frank, you want to jump in there?
Well, I also think that because we know that there is so much fraud connected with kids getting into college who really shouldn't, I mean, don't have the grades but just happen to be good athletes, because there's so many academic scandals, and so few, by the way, that really pop to the surface, I think it tarnishes all of academia. Yes, I know there are a lot of these so-called student athletes who really are students, but a lot of them aren't, and it isn't necessarily their fault. Some of it goes back virtually to junior high, where they were pampered and lied for and cheated for. And so we shouldn't be surprised that they're not really students.
Exactly. And we can't. The big problem, they're scared. They can't deal with the basic issues of how to organize college sports because they've got such a secret that they're stealing from the students. That's where they'd have to start if they were going to be honest. And as a result, the system concentrates power in the athletic officials and the coaches and who are working with the TV executives, who couldn't care less about any of these systems as long as the games go on. But we are concentrating power in precisely those people that are in trouble at Penn State. You know, you're giving them all the power. The athletes quake. They have no recourse. They're terrified of losing their scholarships. They have no rights whatsoever. So we've got an unbalanced system.
So what I want to do is take a break. We have to take a break and a little ID break here. We're going to come back. And David and Gary, you are the first two callers up. We'll come to your phone calls and thoughts, 410-319-8888, here with Taylor Branch and Frank DeFord, talking about Taylor's piece in Atlantic, which is now also an e-book, which we'll talk about, The Shame of College Sports. And we want to hear your thoughts on campus and about the future of college athletics. And I want to hear from both Frank and Taylor, so now what? What do we do? What is the response should be as citizens to take control of what was taken away from us? Is it possible? So we'll take a short break and come right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. We are here with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch from his series on Martin Luther King's life and the life around America, which is an incredible series of books. But he's now got a new e-book called The Cartel, Inside the Rise and Imminent Fall of the NCAA, and the article Shame on College Sports in the October issue of The Atlantic, which started this whole ruckus, and it has caused a ruckus. Frank DeFord joins us by phone. Frank, of course, is a sports commentator for HBO's Real Sports, commentator for National Public Radio, senior contributing writer to Sports Illustrated, and an author of some known. He's written many great books. Let me go right to the phones. I promise the listeners they can get into this. 410-319-8888. We'll go to David first in Baltimore. You got David on the air?
Hello?
Hi, welcome, David.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a parent of one college athlete at the Division II level and a potential one that's being recruited now for next year. It's a good conversation. I'm not going to disagree with any of the points, but my question would be, what can be done to resolve this? Because this starts at the junior high level, and everybody is getting something out of the deal from the writers who are getting paid to report on sports, from the college administrators, from the kids who are getting pampered at every level, from AAU coaches to, kids growing up not knowing how to read or write, but they can bounce a basketball and they can run a football.
Taylor, you want to start off and go to Frank?
The only thing I would say is that you need to have honesty in the system and that people need to begin their education early about what is practical and what is going to serve them in the long run. I know that they love the sports, but right now the colleges tell them that the only way that they should just be fantasize and forget making any money, and whereas in fact all the players see money all around them. And so they either have to become corrupt or they have to become cynical or they have to live in fantasy world. So I just think that honesty is the place that you start. You open it up. Certainly adult athletes in college, if you can start Facebook when you're a college student and make billions or moonlight in a pizza parlor, you ought to be able to have a commercial career in sports and also be a student and be evaluated and you have to learn how to make those two worlds work. But honesty is—it seems to me where it should start.
Frank?
No, that's well said.
Well, let's go to another caller. I think that, and I'm going to come back to what he said. But let me get through some callers first. 410-319-8888. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi guys. First of all, I'm very proud of Frank DeFord and Taylor Branch's Baltimore associations, and Mr. Branch, I particularly want to thank you so much for that trilogy on America and the King years. And thank you so much for bringing Harry Belafonte to your church, I guess about 5 or 6 years ago. And, I was blessed with having an opportunity to meet him.
It was a glorious day. It was a glorious day. Thank you.
Yeah. That being said, I'm a former college athlete. I went to an Ivy League institution. Didn't graduate, but totally agree with everything that both of you gentlemen are saying. But my question is, the point that I'd like to put to you guys to discuss after I hang up is the nexus between politics and sports. There seems to be a preponderance of conservative coaches at the higher levels, particularly. And, you look at, Krzyzewski, Osborne, Switzer, et cetera. And, of course, recently Dave Zirin included you, Mr. Branch, in one of his articles. And he just wrote a book about these sports owners. And, what I'd like you guys to comment on is the nexus between what you're talking about now and its effect on the wider population.
Frank, you want to jump in on that first?
It is rather interesting. I remember doing a commentary on it some years ago. It suddenly occurred to me that Bill Bradley, Senator Bradley at that time, was about the only Democrat who had been an athlete who was a politician. You started with Jim Bunning and Tom Osborne, who the caller mentioned, and so forth. It was very unusual to find a Democrat politician who had come out of sports. And I suppose it sort of fits. A coach is a very much of an authoritarian character. There's not a whole lot of liberalism in running a football team, and so I sort of understand it. On the other hand, It's my experience that Democrats and liberals like sports every bit as much as conservatives.
Amen.
And Republicans. I mean, it's a universal affection, and it goes from country to country. And I don't think that in France or Brazil, the soccer coaches may be conservatives, but the fans, I assure you, go across the spectrum.
I think that's true. The emperor. You know, the current system, by disenfranchising the players, really builds up the emperor qualities in the coaches. And so there's kind of a monarchical quality there that I guess is conservative. But it is true that a lot of liberal fans seem to be especially attached to the notion of amateurism, that there's a purity, that the money dirties this somehow. And so they don't want to hear anything about paying the athletes.
Is there a place... Is there a place, is there a medium ground to come to? I mean, before we started on the air, Taylor, you were saying this has a trickle-down effect of places to smaller colleges like Williams College, many of the colleges that have sports programs where the coach, even though it's not like a billion-dollar program, it has power and influence in the university to recruit students, use scholarships to bring students in just to play sports instead of academic scholarships, that the whole thing is so skewed. I mean, is there a place for amateur athleticism, athletics, inside of a world, if you were going to build a world that's going to start paying college athletes in football and basketball? I mean, how do you create a system that works where some kids who might play soccer or field hockey or lacrosse get nothing, and kids who play football and basketball get everything because it makes money for the university?
Well, to me, amateurism is kind of a sham. Amateurism really works best on yourself. If you want to be an amateur, it's like religious faith. You should do it not as the publicans do it, but in your closet and everything. But to impose amateurism on somebody else doesn't really work very well. The obsession that you're talking about, the obsessive level, I mean, when I went to the Iron Bowl, and I had a lot of fun doing it, between Auburn and Alabama last year, the Cam Newton game, and the whole stadium was chanting scam because of his money. I mean, but on the way there before dawn on the radio, a guy called in the Jeff Paul Feinbaum show saying that he had been up all night thinking about the coin toss and that he couldn't sleep thinking about who was going to win the coin. I mean, the obsession level is really high, and financially it may be the next bubble. It may be a bubble like internet bubble, except it's been going on for a long time. But financially, one of the things that I got the most feedback negative reaction to was quoting Britt Kerwin from here in Maryland, saying that he had done a private survey of all of the presidents of the big football schools, and 95% of them said their athletic budgets are unsustainable. The trajectory, or you know, they cannot they could not control it. They keep wanting to hire more coaches, build bigger. The competitive nature makes them want to build bigger Taj Mahal locker rooms and more things to entertain the boosters and pay the coaches more and more and more. But it's going to burst. So, I think the bubble is going to burst. But amateurism itself is no magic remedy.
Frank.
You do find that even in Division III schools, that there's that sort of the arms race. In other words, no, they're not paying kids, or they're not may not be booster clubs, but everybody wants to win. And so you get some Division III conference, and if somebody brings in an exceptionally good athletic facility, or you know, training facility with weights and everything, then all the other schools have to do it too, because they're all competing for the same kids. And so it does spiral that way. But I don't see any problem in dividing who these student athletes are. See, again, as Taylor pointed out so well, that's the beauty of what the NCAA does, the cynicism of lumping all these student athletes together. And even at a place like Ohio State, there's a huge difference between the kid who plays on the football and the basketball team and the kid who plays, you know, volleyball or field hockey or something like that. And we ought to acknowledge that. And I don't have any problem with paying football players because they bring in the money, and not paying a volleyball player. In the same way, we don't pay actors who act on the campus. you know, or write for the student newspaper. We don't pay them because they don't make any money.
They don't make any. I mean, they're free to ask for money.
Yeah.
That's the thing, or they should be free to ask for money. It's just that honesty would say, well, that's a very interesting idea, but there's no money to pay you. I've had people jump up and down and tell me if you pay athletes, you'd have to pay the marching band.
Yeah.
Well, no, you wouldn't have to pay the marching band. You just tell them there's no money to pay.
But what is that? They're going to go back to the phones. Dimitri, Benny, and Steve, we're going to get your calls after this question. So what happens then to the whole institution? I mean, one of the things we talk a little bit in your piece about, and that Frank, you've written about, is how this whole system in some ways corrupts the entire academic institution. How do you ameliorate that? How do you blunt that, or can you blunt it?
Ask Gordon Gee, the president of Ohio State, who just gave a $5 million or a $10 million or whatever it was, dollar contract to a football coach. And I have a hunch that they're probably firing assistant professors.
Yes.
Or what, you know, or not putting phones in some academic offices. Why, ask Gordon Gee. Does it corrupt the system? Of course it does. And any president will, you know, it's late at night with a drink in his hand, tell you that. We all know that. It's deceitful. It's dishonest.
I had several college presidents tell me, not for the record,
yeah,
that their salaries, their own salaries, were two, possibly three times what they would be were it not for the fact that their trustees were so embarrassed by the gap between them and the football coach. So they're not getting paid by the athletic department, but it's seeping over in there because people are embarrassed. And to me, the solution is it's because they've concentrated all this power in the athletic department, and what you need to do is that the athletes, and in my view, the non-athlete students should be at the table. How are we going to run this at this university? Who are we going to pay? The faculty, who have abdicated in most places, should come back to the table, and the university should make decisions about how they're going to run these sports and how they're going to pay. Maybe some schools would specialize in lacrosse. I don't know what they would do, but right now they've concentrated it all in the athletic department, all the power. They disenfranchise the students. They shut up the rest of the students, who only seem to come awake whenever the athletic department runs such a deficit that they want to raise general student fees, which they do. I mean, it's a total myth that the athletic department subsidizes the economics department,
right,
as Frank is saying.
Oh, yeah,
it runs the other way around. The athletic departments, for all their gigantic million-dollar contracts, they wound up with a deficit because every coach comes landing in the AD's office when they get a new contract saying, I need to hire more coaches and we need more facilities. And then the softball coach comes in. You know, there are $300,000 softball coaches in sports that generate no revenue. So this is really a very, very bizarre system we have.
And who's paying for those coaches? Essentially, the kid who plays left tackle.
Absolutely.
He's paying for the volleyball coach. It's not so bad that he's not getting anything, but he's subsidizing somebody else.
Yep.
That's what makes it even more egregiously deceitful.
I agree, Frank, and I'm thank you for focusing on the guy who plays left tackle, because most people tend to, looking for a way to excuse this system and say amateurism is great, they say, well, Cam Newton is going to get all of his money anyway. But for every Cam Newton, there are 1,000 left tackles who have been doing this and banging themselves all their lives, and this is all they know how to do, and this is the only opportunity. They're never going to play pro sports. The only opportunity they'll have to get a nest egg, and instead they're just going to get bad knees and get discarded.
Absolutely.
410-319-8888 here with Frank Tufort and Taylor Branch. And Dimitri, you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen. I'm glad that you touched on this topic, and you're kind of leading into what my comment was, and it was geared toward Mr. DeFrancis. There was a comment that you had made how these athletes that are playing primarily football, basketball, that are the big money makers in these universities, and these monies get subsidized or sent down to the lesser programs, be it lacrosse, field hockey, as you were mentioning. Do you think that these programs would not exist if these football and basketball were not making the money that they were making at this point?
Well, they have to decide. I mean, one of the things that maybe we ought to go back to is more intramurals. There's a lacrosse league. Now, get this. It stretches from Connecticut to Colorado. A college lacrosse league with some small schools from Connecticut to Colorado. Now, do we really need that? You know, I'm not so sure that you couldn't cut back a great deal on, as Taylor said, the salaries to coaches. And sure, you could run very modest programs so that kids in what are called minor sports could have the opportunity to play. That, after all, is the idea. But
right.
they shouldn't have to get on an airplane and fly halfway across the country to play a game like the football teams and the basketball teams.
The caller is right, though, that a fair system that treated the big sport athletes as adults and bargained for their share of what they're contributing to the university, it would put pressure on all the other sports, the non-revenue sports.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the nature of reality. You have
yeah.
to come together and say, what kind of university do we want to be? Do we want to be one that allows the market to drive out all the swimming and, you know, every sport that doesn't pay its weight? Because quite frankly, to be honest about it, the music department doesn't pay its weight either. The
mm-hmm.
classics department doesn't pay its weight. So if the university wants to start keeping around only those things that are those aspects of the university that make money, then it's going to be the football team, the business school, the basketball team, and maybe the law school, and everywhere else is, you know.
We'll be online, Taylor.
Exactly.
It'll be online.
Oh, my God. This is depressing. Let me go back to the phones.
419-8888. Get rid of the dormitory. Get rid of the classrooms. There's a wonderful, you go back to the Marx Brothers in like 1934, Duck Soup, or one of their movies in which Groucho was playing the dean.
Right.
And they say we've got to get rid of the football team. Well, back then they say, well, we got to get rid of the dean. I mean, this is nothing new.
Let's go to Benny. You're on the line, on the air, excuse me.
Good evening. Maybe we should do What's the Matter You. I don't know. But however, good evening, all.
Good evening.
And what is driving me completely nuts is the American sense of priority in this whole thing. That physics professor that's fighting for tenure is getting, what, $125,000, if that?
If they're lucky.
And that football if they're lucky. And that football coach is getting yet another $7 million contract. That's number one. But the other set of priorities that is driving me crazy, and I haven't heard this issue raised, is the use of steroids among those athletes in college, how it's never really covered and how we really don't know about it, how these student athletes, quote unquote, are being used and abused that way. Has that really been covered? We parade professional athletes in front of Congress dealing with the steroid issue as if we didn't have anything else to do, as if Iraq and Afghanistan didn't matter. So we have to parade professional athletes in front of in front of Congress, but they don't address the athletes in dealing with the steroid issue.
Okay.
I just want to hear your take on that.
So, I don't know too much about that, Frank. I don't know too much about the drug issue in college athletes. I do, of course, from the time I almost played at Georgia Tech back in the 60s, and a huge player was 250 pounds. And, you know, now they might be, you know, in the backfield. Now they are 300 pounds. So they've grown, but I don't really know much about drug policy in college athletes.
It, like everywhere else, is an awareness of the drug problem. And so there's more attention paid to it. That's not to say, though, that obviously athletes not only in college but in high school
mm-hmm.
Use drugs. But I don't think that's really the issue with regard to the NCAA.
No,
I think that the economic issues and the issues of morality and ethics are you know predominate.
Before we run out of time, and we'll get to our next callers, Taylor, talk about what you write about in terms of the imminent fall of the NCAA, where it is now. There's all these plethora of lawsuits. Things are going on, and it really is being hit from a number of sides. So talk a bit about what you think the future is of the NCAA.
It's really scrambling to hang on. It's terrified of a national football playoff, which would invite the schools, the conferences that run it, to say, well, we can run March Madness too, and that would take all of their income. Meanwhile, there are all these antitrust lawsuits going on, and the NCAA is compromising its own principles. It's just in the last month said it's going to pay athletes in the major conferences $2,000, but it tortures the language to say that $2,000 is not pay. Basically, anything the NCAA approves is not pay, because if it were pay, then they would be employees and they could bargain for it and they'd be free agents. The NCAA wants to give them whatever it wants to let fall out of its pocket. And there are now athletes beginning to petition. They're saying this isn't fair. I have gotten calls from state legislatures. I've gotten calls from Congress. There may be hearings on due process. The NCAA went all the way to the Supreme Court to deny due process obligations in its enforcement. So it's surrounded on a number of fronts. And the athletes themselves, I think they may be, these petitions may be unlikely, but I can tell you that all the people I interviewed still lived in terror of the moment when they were afraid that a basketball team would not walk out on the court for the NCAA championship game with hundreds of millions of dollars on the line and just do a wildcat protest saying, why should we be five amateurs out here as forced volunteers to entertain the rest of the country and supply the NCAA budget and subsidize 1,000 schools? Something like that would bring home reality pretty quickly. But I think it's more likely going to be one of these financial things that rips it apart.
How do you see it, Frank?
Well, I think Taylor's, yeah, I think the NCAA is nearing the abyss. But big time college sports, no matter who's running it, I can't see that ever disappearing. That's certainly part of our cultural DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to get rid of big time college football. Nobody's going to get rid of big time college basketball. I think the NCAA will fade away, and I think the players will be paid. I think that's somewhere on the horizon, whether it's 2 years away or 10 years away, but I think we're going to reach that point. I think we must. There's been too much light shed on it, and happily, very much of that by Mr. Branch.
I mean, this is the tip of the discussion. I think there's so much more here to kind of unearth, and I think it's not. We don't have time. We can't jump into this now. But the whole issue of paying athletes, while I'm as you are, come to a point, Taylor, where you say, well, of course, got to do something, and being knee-jerk against it because you're believing this amateur athletics that doesn't even exist.
Right.
But then there's a whole set of problems that goes with what happens to universities and how does this affect the life of a university, which, after all, is about athletics, but it's supposed to be about academics, teaching, learning, creating the future American leaders and professionals. I mean, that's...
But see, I think that it's potentially a way for the university to wake up. They can teach and learn about something that is amazing right under their nose, that is the one topic that universities don't discuss. How are our sports organized? What is our relationship between students and the revenue and academic pursuits which departments actually earn their keep? There's a fascinating education right there on the campus, and unfortunately, because people are so terrified that honesty would divert money from the coaches who they don't do it. So to me, there's a real education right there. I'm not saying they're not hard choices and wrenching adjustments, but I agree with Frank. I think the NCAA is going to go away. Big time college sports are going to stay, but they're going to have to be reformed in a more enlightened era.
Frank DeFord and Taylor Branch, it's been a real pleasure to have you both on the show together. I appreciate
you
taking this. Has been great for both. Thank you so much, Frank, Green, Joyce, and Taylor, for coming in this evening. And we're going to there'll be a link on theastonisher.org to Taylor's new ebook on this called "The Cartel: Inside the Rise and Imminent Fall of the NCAA." I can't talk price, but it's not expensive, and it's also a short book to read, but chock full of stuff. So Taylor Branch, Frank DeFord, thank you both so much. It's been great.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
I remind you, as we take a break here, we're going to come back to our new series, Sound Bites. We're going to come back after this break on transforming our food system and bringing health to America. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. Remember, it is a credit union. It belongs to you, and money comes back to you. We'll be right back. Stay with us.